أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to Sufi Reflections. On a regular, irregular basis, this podcast is intended, God willing, to introduce you to a wide variety of commentaries, ideas, stories, essays, discussions, interviews, and perspectives concerning not only the Sufi path or tasawwuf, but life in general as well. Through fact, fiction, possibilities, questions, and reflections, this podcast seeks to engage you on a journey of discovery in relation to issues and themes of relevance and significance to everyday life. I am not a sheikh, but I have, by the grace of Allah, been on the Sufi path for over 30 years, and I have benefited greatly by working closely with a Sufi saint of the 20th century for nearly two decades. This podcast is not about trying to guide people on the path, but rather to share some of what I and others have learned in conjunction with pursuing a Sufi way of life. My name is Bill Whitehouse, and God willing, I shall be your host for Sufi Reflection.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful.
والفجر وليال عشر والشفع والوتر والليل إذا يسر هل في ذلك قسم لذي حجر ألم تر كيف فعل ربك بعاد إرم ذات العماد التي لم يخلق مثلها في البلاد وثمود الذين جابوا الصخر بالواد وفرعون ذي الأوتاد الذين طغوا في البلاد فأكثروا فيها الفساد فصب عليهم ربك سوط عذاب إن ربك لبالمرصاد
By the dawn and 10 nights and the even and the odd and the night when it departeth there surely is an oath for thinking man Dost thou not consider how thy Lord dealt with the tribe of Ad, with many-columned Iram, the like of which was not created in the lands, and with the tribe of Thamud, who clove the rocks in the valley, and with Pharaoh firm of might, who all were rebellious to Allah in these lands, and multiplied iniquity therein? Therefore thy Lord poured on them the disaster of his punishment. Lo, thy Lord is ever watchful.
فَأَمَّا الْإِنسَانُ إِذَا مَبْتَلَاهُ رَبُّهُ فَأَكْرَمَهُ وَنَعَّمَهُ فَيَقُولُ رَبِّي أَكْرَمَنِ وَأَمَّا إِذَا مَبْتَلَاهُ فَقَدَرَ عَلَيْهِ رِزْقَهُ فَيَقُولُ رَبِّي أَهَانَنِ كلا بل لا تكرمون اليتيم ولا تحاضون على طعام المسكين وتأكلون التراث أكلا لما وتحبون المال حبا جما
As for man, whenever his Lord trieth him by honoring him and is gracious unto him, he saith, My Lord honoreth me. But whenever he trieth him by straitening his means of life, he saith, My Lord despiseth me. Nay, but ye for your part honor not the orphan and urge not on the feeding of the poor. And ye devour heritages with devouring greed. And love wealth with abounding love.
كلا إذا دكت الأرض دكا دكا وجاء ربك والملك صفا صفا وجيء يومئذ بجهنم يومئذ يتذكر الإنسان وأنى له الذكرى يقول يا ليتني قدمت لحياتي فيومئذ لا يعذب عذابه أحد ولا يوثق وثاقه أحد يا أيتها النفس المطمئنة ارجعي إلى ربك راضية مرضية فادخلي في عبادي وادخلي جنتي.
Nay, but when the earth is ground to atoms, grinding, grinding, and thy Lord shall come with angels rank on rank, and hell is brought near that day, on that day man will remember, but how will the remembrance then avail him? He will say, Ah, would that I had sent before me some provision for my life. None punisheth as he will punish on that day. None bindeth as he then will bind. But ah, thou soul at peace, return unto thy Lord content in his good pleasure. Enter thou among my bondmen, enter thou my garden.
Heart in tumult, our hermit beings blunted with the rasp of inward noise, here and now, there, in tomorrow's heart. Ears stuffed with cotton wool, eyes distracted by a single hair sharp as a blade of grass. We wait anxiously for tears of grief to spill over like lava onto our cheeks. Let love invade you and consume that deadening wool. Let your heart become an audience like Halaj, like the audacious saints of purity. You know what happens if you place a naked flame by cotton wool. The fire will eat up its desiccated convulsion. You are skirting on the lip of love, so prepare yourself. Throw open the mantle of your senses to joy. For the lover's death is a willing return on the way to the one. If, entangled in the fingers of grief, you fear death, this is no place for you. So far as this existence is a prison, which bricks up our senses, the destruction of the cell is our innocent ambition. But his prison is like a palace. His palace is a heaven. There's no lasting monument in this life, where even mountains are like balls of cotton. In this faithless circus of passing beauty, there's no belonging in the hovel of space and time. There is no loyalty. The foregoing poem comes from the book Words of Paradise, Selected Poems of Rumi, New Interpretations by Rafiq Abdullah. One of the features that, God willing, will run fairly regularly on this podcast is a segment entitled Sufi Essays. As the title suggests, these pieces will be commentaries, sometimes brief and sometimes longer, about a variety of topics which, hopefully, may provide you with some thoughts on which to reflect. This essay is about expectations. Harboring expectations can be a major source of difficulty. This is true both for people who are considering initiation, as well as for those who already have stepped onto the path. These expectations generally can be subsumed under roughly five categories. More specifically, one can have expectations in relation to 1. God, 2. The spiritual guide, 3. The nature of the mystical path, 4. The conduct and character of other people on the path, and 5. Oneself. One of the problems most of us have in one form or another is we try to stuff God into our theories and conceptual frameworks. On the basis of these perspectives, we develop a series of expectations about what God should be and how God should be. Furthermore, we often set trials and tests which God is expected to ace if divinity is to pass muster. For example, we may say to ourselves,
If God is to be a God worthy of our praise and worship, then God must do this or that, and thereby meet our expectations of how God should act. Alternatively, we may think to ourselves, if God wants our spiritual business, then God must be able to satisfy our carefully prepared 15-point diagnostic checklist. We then proceed to try to hoist God up on the examination table and check for weaknesses, defects, and warning signs. Different people draw up different kinds of diagnostic checklists to run God through. However, all of these lists are rooted in expectations we have of how God should be. We believe, for instance, that God must be good, or God must be a loving God, or God must be just. In addition, we have our own incompletely worked out and often inconsistent theories of goodness, love, and justice. We then proceed to set up expectations which require God to conform to the structural requirements and values embedded in our thinking. Rarely do we stop and seek to discover what goodness or love or justice means to God. Rarely do we ask ourselves what, if anything, justifies our theories of goodness, love, or justice. Our opinions and beliefs are not justified just because we hold them to be so. Where is the reality check in all of this? From the perspective of Sufi masters, we distance ourselves from God in direct proportion to the weight of the baggage of expectations we try to impose on God. Indeed, expectations are one of the ways through which veils of ignorance and darkness are generated on the path. Furthermore, Sufi masters suggest we have the cart before the horse in this matter of expectation. If we wish to realize what can be expected from God, then first come to know God as God and not as a function of our theories about God. Let us open ourselves up to the reality of God and let God show us the errors in our various expectations. People also can have strange sorts of expectations about a spiritual guide. Upon meeting a teacher, we often expect a spiritual version of fireworks, or a dazzling ethereal floor show, or a display of beautiful otherworldly lights and auras to be radiating from the countenance of the Sheikh, or breathtaking discourses which probe into the inner sanctum of metaphysical truths. If we don't experience these, we are disappointed. Our expectations have been violated. We begin to have doubts about the authenticity of the teacher. After all, if this person were truly a spiritual guide, then surely this individual would be this way or that way. The irony of the situation is this. All of the things we, however unfairly and unjustifiably, may expect concerning the nature of a spiritual guide could be occurring before our eyes, ears, and mind, but we are too blind and ignorant to grasp the reality of what is in front of us. God is not under any obligation to disclose spiritual secrets to every Tom, Dick, and Mary who comes along. Similarly, spiritual guides are under no compulsion to share their secrets either. In addition, we are being presumptuous to suppose our condition is sufficiently worthy to be permitted access to such realities. Although sometimes, even when we are not worthy of such participation, spiritual generosity comes to our rescue. In any event, the absence of perceived mystical quote-unquote signs in the being or demeanor of someone who may or may not be a genuine spiritual teacher is neither here nor there. A person could be an authentic teacher, and yet we might not sense anything special about that person. At the same time, The absence of visible marks of grace does not necessarily permit us to conclude the individual is a genuine teacher who is merely veiling himself or herself from others. The fact of the matter is, if we really knew what was what, spiritually speaking, we wouldn't be in the predicament of having to find a teacher. In the meantime, we tend to thrash around in the dense jungle of our expectations of things. In concert with the foregoing kind of expectations, there is a tendency on the part of many people to confuse the purely human side of a teacher with the spiritual side of a teacher. For example, we may meet someone who is, let us assume, a genuine teacher. Perhaps we see this person eating, and we think to ourselves, gee, this person eats more than a guide should eat, or the way the teacher eats somehow doesn't sit right with our expectations of how a spiritual person ought to eat, whatever way that is. Maybe the guide watches television or goes to movies. Again, this may jar our spiritual sensibilities. Maybe the teacher has interests or activities which are inconsistent with our expectations concerning the nature of a sheikh. Maybe the guide does not exhibit as much patience, tolerance, laughter, and so on as we feel is appropriate or in the way we deem to be proper. Without in any way wishing to maintain that a spiritual guide has license to do anything and everything he or she pleases, and without wishing to say there are no constraints of propriety within which a teacher is bound to operate, nonetheless, there are degrees of freedom available to a teacher. Through these permissible degrees of freedom, the teacher can give expression to the purely human side without compromising the spiritual side of things. The friends of God come in many shapes, sizes, colors, temperaments, and capacities. They are not all the same, nor do they need to be. The operative words in the above are, quote, friends of God, end of quote. A friend of God makes sincere, heartfelt efforts not to do anything on the human side which might undermine or adversely affect the spiritual side. God, on the other hand, permits friends to have some discretion in how they conduct their human lives. However, sometimes even friends make mistakes. When this is brought to their attention by the friend, with a capital F, they repent and seek God's forgiveness. Most of us are not in any position to sort out possible spiritual mistakes of the friends of God from the degree of latitude which God has permitted to those same friends. To be sure, one ought not to abandon one's capacity for critical reflection in relation to such issues. Nevertheless, one is entering very dangerous and tricky territory when one establishes a set of expectations to which the teacher must conform in order to be a judged and authentic teacher. Almost everyone who is contemplating stepping onto the mystical path, or who already has done so, has many expectations about the nature of the spiritual path. For instance, one may have expectations how easy or difficult the mystical journey is going to be. One also may have expectations about what one will receive from pursuing the path, such as mystical powers, spiritual gifts, visions, insights, goals, and so on. In addition, one may have expectations about how and when and where and why mystical experiences take place. One reads or hears about some of the mystical experiences of others. As a result, one builds up expectations concerning the arrival of such experiences in one's own case. Sufi masters point out there are a number of things one can do to help make the spiritual journey go more easily and more quickly. One of these beneficial actions is to throw overboard, without a life preserver, one's expectations about the nature of the Sufi path. The sooner one does this, the better off one will be. Every spiritual journey is unique because everyone's relationship with God is unique. While there are shared themes and concerns from one journey to the next, one should just let the path unfold of its own accord and in its own way. If we look after our responsibilities, the path will look after its responsibilities. Expectations only delay and complicate matters. In addition to our expectations concerning God, the spiritual guide and the nature of the mystical path, we also frequently tend to have expectations with respect to other people, both those on as well as those outside of the Sufi journey. For instance, we may have expectations about how they ought to or will behave, or what they will and will not understand. We also may have expectations about their interests, commitments, and values. Alternatively, we may have expectations about what their lifestyle is like, and so on. Quite often, people who are not on a mystical journey, at least in any discernible sense, will surprise one with the depth of their understanding about spiritual matters. This surprise is the result of an expectation concerning such people. One could run into people outside of the path who may exhibit a variety of spiritual qualities, commitments, and interests that one might have thought would only be found by someone who had taken initiation with a spiritual guide. The unexpected dimension of such an encounter is, once again, the sign of an expectation which is being rebuffed. On the other hand, one may meet with people who have become initiated into a mystical tradition, and yet they don't seem to understand anything of a spiritual nature. Moreover, such people may not be leading the sort of lifestyle one thought would be second nature to a wayfarer of the mystical way. Here, too, expectations are being exposed. According to the Sufi masters, the best policy is not to have any expectations at all, either with respect to people on or outside of the mystical path. If one does this, one will never be disappointed, and more often than not, one will be able to appreciate people on their own terms. We all have spiritual potential. We all have spiritual problems. We all have our strengths and weaknesses. We all have dimensions we hold in common, and we all have our unique quality. Sufi masters suggest we should not meet others with expectation. Instead, we should meet them with friendship. Finally, we all carry expectations concerning ourselves in relationship to the mystical path. Some of these expectations are rooted in low self-esteem. Others of these expectations are embedded in high self-esteem. The masters of the Sufi path suggest we dispense with both kinds of expectations. The practitioners of the Sufi path indicate that if we get rid of these kinds of expectation, then, God willing, we will become receptive to truths about our essential self, which will put to shame both our sense of low esteem as well as our feelings of high esteem. The following poem is entitled Explosive Questions for September 11th. Have you heard about the living dead, who move among us as a corrupted moral essence, though several commissions have tried to mask their presence? Did you heed the call of ideology to stay clear of outrageous theories of conspiracy, which was shamelessly spun from defective yarns? Did you know there are engineers whose souls show fault lines that place humanity at risk by setting evil free to commit more atrocity? I have many questions about that day, For instance, I would like to hear what they have to say concerning Building 7. Explosive questions that won't go away. Do you proudly hail members of Congress whose hearts suffer from a malady of conscience that has left them deaf, dumb, and blind to September crimes? Are you informed now that the media has confused propaganda with facts while urging us to adopt paranoia as a way of life? Did you salute the cool bravery of military leaders who completely shirked their duty towards an enemy, both foreign and homegrown? I have many questions about that day. For instance, I would like to hear what they have to say concerning Pierre Brunel. Explosive question that won't go away. Have you been properly enlightened by professors who arbitrarily treat duplicity as a quality of truth and justice? Do you feel safer from the terrorists who roam freely within halls of justice, guilty not of failed intelligence, but failed integrity? Does your heart not soar on taxed wings of the heirs to 9/11? More war, torture, tyranny, and an obscenely healthy defense industry. I have many questions about that day. For instance, I would like to hear what they have to say concerning David Shippers. Explosive questions that won't go away. For those who may be interested, my new book, The Essence of September 11th, has been released and is ready for distribution. If you would like more information about this work, just go to theessenceofseptember11th.org. That's theessenceofseptember11th.org. That's all one word. And click on the information link near the top of that webpage. Among other things, you can read an excerpt from the book. In addition, there is a short video about the book, as well as links to other web pages within the website that contain a wealth of facts about September 11th. You have been listening to Rob Koslow's I Do from his Sophomore Jinx CD, courtesy of and available through magnatunes.com. For thousands of years, the hearts, minds, and souls of people have been captivated by the telling of stories that give expression to moral and spiritual teachings. The heart of such stories resonates with our own essence in ways that inspire, intrigue, entertain, and mystify us in relation to human potential. The short stories presented through this segment of Sufi Reflections podcast cover many different facets of spirituality, exploring the twists and turns of the heart seeking for truths that transport one beyond the usual and the expected, into realms fraught with unusual, unanticipated perils and/or self-realizing possibilities. These stories are intended to assist listeners towards reflecting on many themes, problems, and questions of importance to the human heart. Some of the stories told here constitute a refashioning of stories told in faraway times, places, and cultures. Some of these stories are wholly original in format, while still serving as a venue for traditional principles, values, and teachings of the spiritual way of life. Cul-de-sac is the title of the following story. The king had been obsessed with fate and death for as long as he could remember. He didn't know precisely when his intense preoccupation with these intertwined realities had begun, but begun it had, and gradually the ideas of death and fate had come to consume nearly every waking moment. Some children had a favorite toy which played a central role in their early lives. Other children had an imaginary friend who kept them company through difficult times. As a boy, during adolescence, and into young adulthood, the king's constant companion had been thoughts of these daunting twins. The triggering events which helped precipitate his condition may have been the many wars that had been fought during his childhood. So many of the kingdom's families had lost fathers, sons, and brothers during their collective dark nights of the soul. Or maybe the terrible plagues which had swept through the lands, taking the lives of numerous men, women, and children along the way, somehow had planted a deadly seed of another kind deep within the king's subconscious. Undoubtedly, the foregoing sort of factors played contributing roles, but the king suspected that the real source of his anxieties and fears started when the stranger who seemed to have paid a visit to the boy's room one night a long, long time ago. Quite frankly, the king had not even been sure whether what took place that night was a dream or something else, but the experiences had stayed with him. Whenever he permitted his thoughts to drift in the direction of quote-unquote the event from his childhood, the whole scene would occupy his consciousness like an invading force. The experience was just as vivid now as it had been some three decades ago when it first occurred. As young boys are wont to do, he had been lying in bed listening to the sounds of the night, thinking about the events of the day, planning what he would do tomorrow, when he heard a noise of some sort, like someone clearing his or her throat. The noise had come from the corner of his room, which was always in shadows at night. Even when the full moon shone through his window, as it did on this occasion, all his attention was drawn to that portion of the room. He peered into the darkness of the corner, and although he couldn't see anything, nonetheless, he felt a presence of some sort. He knew with certainty he was not alone. A strange fear descended on him. He became paralyzed. All he could do was look and listen. Every so often, he remembered to breathe. While only a few minutes probably actually transpired, the event seemed to take hours to unfold. Finally, the boy who would be king heard a voice arise out of the shadows. The voice was neither masculine nor feminine. The words had a quality which penetrated to the very core of his being. It said, "Prince, if you wish to live forever, then you must never hear either the complete words or music, for..." Something was whispered softly. What was whispered was unclear. In his mind, he tried to concentrate on recreating what had been said to him, but the words remained indistinct. The boy managed to summon enough courage to stammer, What did you say?" There was a mocking laughter that softly began echoing in the room. The boy was near tears. The laughter was replaced by an eerie silence. Then, once again, something was whispered. Seemingly this time, the words came from somewhere very near to his ears, even though the boy could detect no one near the head of his bed, as he managed to shift his eyes left and right, while the rest of him remained paralyzed. This time the words were said a little more loudly, yet still were somewhat muffled. The boy thought he understood what had been whispered, but he wasn't completely sure. "Please," said the youngster, "can't you say the name of the song clearly?" Only the sound of the wind could be heard. Otherwise, the passage of time was marked by grains of quiet. The strain of intently trying to listen for who knows how long, as well as the stress brought on by his fear, had completely tired the boy out, and as he was drifting off to sleep, he heard, "If you follow these instructions, you will never die." Soon after the eventful night, the boy's father passed away. The prince became the new king, and from the moment he ascended the throne, he banned all music and singing in the kingdom. Although the boy believed he knew what had been whispered to him that night, he wasn't quite sure. Therefore, the safest thing to do was to create circumstances that would completely control what might happen in relation to hearing music and singing. The boy king's royal edict had a profound effect on others. The kingdom had a long, rich musical history, with many talented musicians, singers, and writers. Now, all the singers, composers, orchestras, and musicians were forced into a state of quiescence. The king dispatched spies throughout the land. Whoever was caught singing or playing music was thrown into prison. The king didn't want to take a chance that somehow, inadvertently, he might hear the wrong song in its entirety, and as a result, bring his life to an end. In addition, all schools were instructed to begin teaching children that music and singing were great evils. Children were given generous rewards for reporting any violations of the king's proclamation that they might witness in their homes or neighborhoods. Scholarships were awarded every year to those students who wrote the best essays about the music problem. From time to time, of course, people throughout the kingdom continued to die. However, the king lived on, and therefore, the purpose of his proclamation was served. The king became so convinced of the wisdom underlying his ban of music and singing, he began to engage in high-risk activities, confident he could cheat death as long as he observed the conditions of that momentous night of his childhood. The king's boldness and daring deeds became the stuff of epic poems, which had to be recited in monotones for fear of any hint of musical melody creeping into a recitation. One day, while traveling in a very remote region of his country, the king met a young woman and fell deeply in love with the maiden. Happily, the woman felt the same way towards him as the king did towards her. Soon thereafter, the two were married, and following the honeymoon, they returned to the king's castle. Although initially the king was extremely happy with his wife, events took an ominous turn not too long after they were married. The king had been walking in the gardens which surrounded the castle, thinking about his queen, feeling very fortunate with respect to having her as his wife, and enjoying the love he felt for her, a love which was growing with each passing day. Just as he had become ensconced in a very pleasant reverie concerning her, he heard something that deeply disturbed him. Singing was drifting down from the window of the queen's room. Unmistakably, the voice was that of his wife. He rushed into the castle and fled up the stairs towards the queen's room. He burst into his wife's room without seeking permission and angrily roared, "Just because you are queen, this does not give you the right to break the royal ban on music and singing?" The queen was shocked and puzzled, shocked at the king's behavior and puzzled concerning the ban. She had never heard of such a proclamation, since news of and from the kingdom hardly ever reached the distant part of the country where she had been raised. She explained this to the king. While her explanation helped calm him a little, nonetheless, he remained agitated and upset. The king had never told anyone about his childhood experience. He did not feel comfortable in doing so now. Nevertheless, he could not have her singing due to his fear of what he had been told that night many years ago. He said with great emotion, "Please, if you love me, you will not sing any more. I beg you not to sing." "Is there something wrong with my voice?" she asked. "No, there is nothing the matter with your voice," he replied. "You sing beautifully. I simply cannot have this sort of thing going on in the castle. If I let you sing and do nothing, then I will become known as a royal hypocrite. I have thrown many people into prison who have violated my ban on singing and music, so how can I let you sing but not extend the same right to them?" "Well," inquired the queen, "what would be so wrong about permitting people to sing and play music? Why not free the people you have imprisoned and do away with your ban?"
I can't explain it," said the king, "but you don't know what you are asking of me. All I can say is that if you love me and care for me, you will refrain from singing."
The queen's face registered mixed emotions. "I do love you," she said, "and if it means all that much to you, I will stop singing. On the other hand, I think you need to understand that singing is very important to my sense of peace and happiness, and so, in a way, you don't know what you are asking of me. In fact, I feel very badly for the people of your kingdom, because they are being prevented from doing something which has been nurturing their souls for centuries. If you cared at all about your loyal subjects, if you loved them as a king should love those who have been entrusted to him, then you would reverse your silly and arbitrary ruling." The queen's words entered the king's heart like a bolt of lightning. He could not deny the truth in her words, nor could he overlook how important a role singing and music played in the life of his wife. If he loved her, how could he possibly deny her the great source of joy and satisfaction in her life?
If he loved his subjects, how could he have treated them so cruelly? How could he permit his own selfishness to adversely shape the lives of so many people? Yet he loved life dearly, and furthermore, if he were to die, then what about the sadness which his wife, whom he knew loved him deeply, would experience in relation to his demise? The immovable object of his childhood experience was being placed into opposition with the irresistible force of his love concerning his wife. What should he do? For many days he reflected on this matter. His heart was being torn apart in seemingly irreconcilable directions. Eventually, after struggling with the issue for some time, he realized he loved his wife more than he loved his own life. She was the empress of his heart. She was the ruler of his destiny. He repealed his earlier edict. He freed from prison those who previously had violated the ban, and seeking to make amends, he lavished great wealth on those whom he had wronged. His wife was so pleased with him that she fell in love with him more than ever before. The two were very happy together, and the kingdom was happy for them as well. Despite his change of heart, the king could not stop worrying about the forces which he had set loose with his new royal proclamation. He became entranced whenever he heard his wife sing, and yet there was a sweet sadness that permeated this listening, as if each time he might be hearing his own swan song. The king was nearing his 50th birthday, and in honor of the occasion, the queen had arranged for a special celebration. She wanted the party to be a surprise, so for months she induced many of the courtiers to become co-conspirators in her secret preparation. The night of the king's birthday came, and he was taken to the great banquet hall on a pretext. There, waiting for him, was his beloved wife and many of his adoring subjects who had long since forgiven the king for his earlier ban on music. A great meal was served. Entertainers performed before, during, and after the meal. Towards the end of the celebration, the queen stood up and announced that to commemorate the occasion, she had commissioned a song to be written. The queen herself would sing the song, and she would be accompanied by a small group of musicians who had been especially assembled for this occasion. The ensemble came to center stage, the music began, and the queen sang. Tears came to the eyes of the king, not only because of the great beauty of the melody, words, instrumentation, his wife's voice, and the festive, joyous atmosphere of those attending the celebration, but because somehow he knew in his heart that this was the song about which he had been warned so many years ago in his childhood. This is what had been whispered into his ears that night. As he was listening, he tried to feel the fullness of life, its joys and its sorrows. He looked at everything in the hall anew and appreciated it for being part of his life, and he was grateful for having been given so many years as he had lived and for having been opened up to the great love of his life. As he was surveying the crowd and the musicians, the king noticed that one of the musicians was intently looking at him. The man was playing his instrument wonderfully, as if the king were the only one in the room for whom he was playing. The king knew whom he was looking at. The king knew that death had come for him that night. After the song was finished and the crowd, including the king, gave a standing ovation for a performance which would take its place near the top of the great musical tradition of the kingdom, making a legend of the queen. The musician, who had been focusing on the king throughout the performance, silently motioned him to meet on the balcony behind the stage. Slowly, the king made his way to the balcony where the two were alone. Death said, "Why didn't you listen to the counsel you were given so many years ago? You could have lived forever, You allowed yourself to be maneuvered into a street from which there is no escape. Things might have been otherwise. The king looked at death. His eyes passed over the land of the kingdom, which was bathed in the light of a full moon. His vision went into the hall where he could see his wife talking with people, receiving their congratulations for her truly marvelous performance. He had never loved his wife more than he did at that very moment. Then his eyes returned to the face of death. He said, "Sir, we all seal our own fates. We can't avoid this." His gaze went back to his wife. "I just exchanged one fate for a better one. Now, let us get on with the business at hand."
From near the outer rim of the Milky Way galaxy, you are listening to the Sufi Reflections podcast.
This may be of interest only to listeners in America, but recently, by the grace of God, I completed a 90-plus page essay dealing with the United States Constitution and its amendments. More specifically, the essay explores a variety of problems which have arisen in conjunction with the Constitution and the manner in which it is being interpreted both by jurists and the average citizen in the United States. There are many challenges and difficulties that exist within democracy as currently practiced in America. The essay provides an overview of these problems and offers a possible solution to them. For more information, go to theessenceofseptember11th.org. That's theessenceofseptember11th.org. That's all one word. Click on the information link at the top of the page, and when you get to that page, scroll down to the bottom of the page to the essay entitled "The New Old Common Sense." And you can either follow the links to that essay, or you can download a PDF file of the essay free of charge.
Thank you.
The foregoing selection is called Freedom, and is from Jeff Wall's CD entitled Guinevere. This has been made possible through the courtesy and cooperation of Magnatunes.com.
The Sufi path is not just about aspiring to spiritual understanding concerning the potential of one's inherent God-given capacity, but as well, tasawwuf should entail an application of spiritual principles to the problems and events of everyday life. Consequently, from time to time, this podcast will offer reflections on different facets of various social, political, economic, and ecological issues of the day. The purpose of these commentaries is not to induce people to pursue this or that action or policy. Rather, the intention of such commentaries is to provide food for thought, which, God willing, may serve to support responsible, moral, considered action according to one's circumstances and best understanding. For want of a better name, I refer to these occasional commentaries as White House Briefs. Although given my nature, some of the commentaries are not always so brief.
The title of this edition of White House Briefs is The Qualities of a Teacher. There may be many individuals within education and the general area of spirituality who have the qualities that are to be described in what follows. However, I tend to doubt this is so. For if such were true, then education, public, private, higher, and spiritual, as well as society, would be vastly different than is unfortunately the case. On a personal level, there are only a precious few individuals with whom I have had the good fortune to come into contact who gave expression to all the qualities outlined in what follows. Moreover, of this select group, only one came from within formal education, and this person also happened to be an authentic spiritual guide. My sample, of course, is limited and possibly skewed by my own biases. Nonetheless, I have been exposed to school systems in a number of countries and on a variety of levels, both as a student and teacher. In addition, I have had the opportunity to interact with a variety of individuals who are alleged to be authentic sheikhs. I wish with all my heart I could report that the sort of qualities about to be explored were far more prevalent than what I have been able to observe. This does not seem to be the case, although every now and then one comes across truly remarkable human beings who are teachers in every sense of this word. There is much that could be said about any of the following qualities. The intention here is merely to offer an overview of each one, something of a thumbnail sketch. Furthermore, the qualities are introduced in no particular order of importance, since in truth, all of them are in many ways equally important. The first quality is honesty. Although always guided by a sense of propriety concerning circumstances, a teacher is someone who bears witness to the truth as she or he understands it and does so without preaching rancor or being overbearing. More often than not, this honesty is given expression according to the perceived need of a person or persons for what is being said or done, as well as the ability of the ones with whom the teacher is interacting to handle and make use of what is being said or done. Depending on circumstances and perceived needs, what is said and or done by a teacher may be issued in a diplomatic fashion, or it may be expressed more directly and openly. Second quality is being committed. The duty of care is always directed towards the needs of the one who is seeking after learning and understanding. The commitment is not to society, government, business, parents, or school, but to the individual
And this is done with the knowledge that if the needs of the individual are properly attended to, then society, business, parents, and the school will all benefit as a result of the primary directive, as it were, being served. A corollary of the foregoing principle is that a teacher would never sacrifice the needs, interests, and potential of students for the self-centered, self-serving, and arbitrary whims of politicians, officials, administrators, or unions. A third quality is flexibility. A teacher is not tied to any preconceived way of doing things. He or she is open to the possibilities of the moment and is prepared to pursue whatever avenues that appear to be most resonant with the needs, interests, and circumstances of those who are seeking after knowledge and understanding. If something is tried and is not working, in the sense of lacking in heuristic value for the other participants, the teacher will be ready to switch gears. Another quality is humility. The sort of teachers I have in mind do not think of their abilities, talents, accomplishments, or experiences as reflecting something special about them as individuals. They are quick to acknowledge the help, guidance, efforts, and support of other people as being more responsible for what they are and have than is anything which comes from them as individuals. Another quality is being balanced. Teachers bring emotional, cognitive, community, interpersonal, economic, physical, and spiritual dimensions together in due proportions. They recognize human nature is complex and that the health of that nature depends on the integration of various potentials within human beings. Another quality is to be democratic. These teachers are not necessarily right or left of center or even involved in political life, but they have an abiding devotion to issues of freedom, justice, fairness, equality, and truth as benchmarks that are crucial to the viability and success of education, spirituality, and community. These issues are not just theoretical entities to them, but are meant to be put into practice in order to benefit all participants. Yet the manner of implementation is not only non-authoritarian or non-coercive in character, but seeks to find paths to either consensus or ways of operating within a framework of acknowledged and accepted differences of perspective. Another quality is being respectful. Such teachers do not intrude into the lives of people and will accept the boundaries that are established. At the same time, they are ready to respond in whatever way they can when invitations are extended. Another quality is character. Such teachers offer models of values, ethics, and/or spirituality through who they are and what they do, not by lecturing. They do not necessarily speak about kindness, generosity, love, tolerance, patience, or compassion. Rather, they are these things and give expression to them through the way they go about life. Another quality is consistency. What these sort of teachers say is reflected in what they do, and vice versa. They are not different in different circumstances, but always centered within their sense of self, although often in low-key ways. They are sincere in everything they do and say, without being annoying in the process. Another quality is they are given to reciprocity. Such qualities as trust, openness, warmth, respect, and friendliness are treated as two-way streets for which the teacher has the primary duty of care with respect to establishing precedence in each case. Another quality is tolerance. A teacher recognizes that people come in all manner of shapes, sizes, colors, temperaments, interests, needs, personalities, beliefs, and values. The goal is not to change people in ways that are predetermined, but to work with them according to their capacity and ability to help them realize their potential. Another quality is to be realistic. Such teachers understand the way things are politically, socially, economically, biologically, and emotionally. Yet, without trying to persuade others to adopt any particular point of view, they do whatever they can to help prepare individuals to deal with these realities in a manner that will not open either individuals or society to the destructive potentials which are inherent in human beings, both individually and collectively. Another quality is being idealistic. Such teachers are committed to qualities like truth, freedom, justice, equality, fairness, love, compassion, kindness, and honesty. In addition, while they realize that these qualities are often only approachable as a limit, nevertheless, they spend their lives seeking to realize these qualities in deeper and more refined ways, so that others may benefit through the teacher being the best that he or she can be. Another quality is sense of self. Such teachers know who they are. They are aware of both their strengths and their weaknesses. They appreciate their history, and they have a destination towards which they are striving, as well as a means through which to undertake the journey. Another quality is being unambitious. They are unconcerned with achieving career status, monetary rewards, or recognition by others. Teaching is not a means to something else, but a way of sharing whatever they have with others. Another quality is independence. The road less traveled seems to be their preferred path. They do not operate according to the expectations of others, nor do they change themselves to suit the likes and dislikes of those around them. Yet they tend not to be confrontational, arrogant, or belligerent in the manner through which they give expression to their independence. Another quality is being supportive. Such teachers offer a context of security within which individuals can explore possibilities without fear of ridicule or adverse consequences for making mistakes. They encourage people to find out about themselves and the world around them, but they do so at their own pace, as well as in accordance with their own particular package of capacities, talents, and interests. Another quality is being humanitarian. Such teachers love people, believe in them, wants them to realize whatever potential they have and be happy in doing so. They care for people and will do whatever she or he can to assist people along the path of life. Another quality is being courageous. In a very unassuming way, such teachers have faced the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune and have opposed them, not with arms, but with steadfastness, optimism, and a willingness, if necessary, to fail while committing all that one has and is to the process of life. Another quality is being self-critical. Such teachers are very aware of their own weaknesses or limitations, along with the need to continually make efforts to improve as a person. Moreover, they are open to receiving criticism from others, accepting what is true, discarding the rest, and using what is true to try to become better human being. Another quality is challenging. Such teachers have an aura about them that, to slightly paraphrase Jack Nicholson's line to Helen Hunt, quote, makes you want to be a better person, end of quote. Their very mode of being in the world inspires people and in the process induces others to seek to explore, learn, discover, and make efforts towards self-realization. Another quality is being friendly. Such teachers do not approach people as teachers or educators or instructors, but as friends who are their well-wishers. They are there for people when the latter need them. They are protective, faithful, and non-judgmental. They listen and care about what they are hearing. Another quality is being rigorous. Such teachers operate in accordance with a set of standards which critically probes experience in a deliberate, thorough, considered, and patient manner. They are not inclined to accept facile or shallow answers, either from themselves or others. They enjoy pushing the envelope on matters of critical inquiry. Another quality is being teachable. Such teachers demonstrate a willingness to learn from their interactions with others. They are aware of the many facets of their own ignorance and treat the insights and abilities of others, including those of so-called quote-unquote students, as so many found treasures. Another quality is being optimistic. This is not the optimism of Voltaire's Dr. Pangloss, but that of someone who has faith in human beings when the latter are provided with degrees of freedom necessary to explore, develop, and realize individual human potential. This is an optimism in the idea that opportunity arising in a context free from exploitive, authoritarian, abusive, and manipulative influences will be embraced by those who are trusted with the duties of care which accompany such opportunity. They know there will be exceptions to this principle, but they do not let this sort of risk get in the way of that which would benefit the many. Another quality is being open. Such teachers are guileless. They are people of integrity and tend to treat others as people of integrity as well. An integrity which entails respect, honesty, sincerity, and an absence of duplicity. On the other hand, they are not inclined to be people who provide one with more personal information than one wishes to hear. Another quality is being forgiving. Such teachers understand that mistakes and errors are part of what being human involves. They recognize that mistakes and errors form an important part of the fabric of experience out of which learning arises. They are inclined to help people to develop maturity through encounters with such problems and then move on to other issues without letting interpersonal history interfere with opportunities for learning. Another quality is that they are unassuming. Such teachers are not pretentious with respect to what they know or have done. They are comfortable with what they understand, but have no need to impose this on others or force others to acknowledge such thing. Furthermore, they have no expectations concerning how others with whom they interact should approach learning. Another quality is being appreciative. Such teachers have gratitude for the gift of life and embrace the many levels of opportunity which life offers human beings. They appreciate the efforts and struggles of anyone who sincerely seeks to take advantage of such opportunity. Another quality is being inquisitive. Such teachers are inclined to ask important, essential questions about truth, justice, freedom, equality, purpose, identity, love, commitment, beliefs, values, and understanding. They do not have an idle curiosity, but are inquisitive about human nature and what it means to be, rather than not at all. More often than not, they represent a model of how to ask questions and what kinds of questions are important to reflect upon, but simultaneously allow people to be free to find their own way to solutions to these questions that make sense within the framework of a given individual's circumstances, interests, and abilities. Another quality is being generous. Such teachers are free with their knowledge, time, help, personal resources, and encouragement. They are forthcoming in their praise and appreciation of others without trying to flatter people or give them a false sense of accomplishment. Another quality is being patient. Such teachers know that understanding and learning do not always come easily for everyone in all situations. They are cognizant of individual differences in circumstances, development, ability, temperament, interests, and aptitude. They have some degree of insight into the many factors which need to come together in order for important kinds of learning to occur. They wait, observe, listen, and try to be receptive to the advent of so-called teachable moment. But in the meantime, they do whatever they can to pave the way to such moments or to make them more likely to occur than not. They do not have a hidden agenda, nor do they feel the need to cover so much material of a particular kind in a given time. Another quality is that they have a sense of humor. They do not take themselves too seriously. They can enjoy the lighter side of life as well as poke fun at some of the absurdities which are disclosed through the locus of manifestation known as a human being, including themselves. In addition, without being disrespectful or insensitive to circumstances, they often take some of the edge away from life's darker side through laughter. Another quality is being fair. More often than not, essential learning and understanding arise out of circumstances in which an individual is comfortable with and trusts those circumstances. An important component in the development of such a sense of comfort and trust is to feel that one is being treated fairly. A teacher acknowledges this and does whatever is possible and feasible to create such circumstances by, among other things, removing as much arbitrariness, artificiality, bias, favoritism, prejudice, and irrelevancy as possible from the context of would-be learning, all of which serve as cultures conducive to the growth of unfairness. Another quality is being pragmatic. Such teachers make do with what is reasonably available to those who are seeking to learn and understand. Teachers encourage students to do as well, but in addition, encourage the latter to be resourceful and creative in relation to discovering what is amenable to being used in the pursuit of learning. Another quality is being gentle. As much as possible, teachers employ non-intrusive means for stimulating opportunities for learning and understanding. This means that whenever possible, they employ modalities that are devoid of influences which are punitive, destructive of self-esteem, rooted in extrinsic rewards, competitive, or steeped in stress, all of which have been shown experimentally and clinically to interfere with learning, both short-term as well as long-term. Another quality of such teachers is competence. As some might say, such individuals, quote-unquote, got game in relation to life. Whatever they know in the way of facts, method, history, names, formulae, and or ideas is secondary to their grasp of the principles of how to engage life in order to work towards the realization of individual potential. This is not to say that the former sort of things are necessarily unimportant, although they often are, but the priorities must be clear. To possess the former in the relative absence of the latter is, for the most part, extremely limited and limiting, if not altogether useless. Another quality is to be uncompromising. Such teachers are uncompromising when it comes to abiding by the truth in terms of themselves, but without making anyone else feel, in the process, that the latter are expected to follow suit or are being judged according to whether or not the latter go along with what the teacher says or does. Another quality is to be self-sacrificing. Such teachers are willing to take a hit in order to protect, support, and serve their student. And yet, a teacher often does this in private and without others knowing that it is being done. They do not see such behavior as being self-sacrificial, but as being part of the duty of care which any friendship deserves. The last quality is being protective. Such teachers understand all too well what awaits students once the latter are removed from the sanctuary that arises within the sphere of influence which has been established through a teacher's manner of giving expression to the duties of care entailed by the vocation of teaching. A teacher tries to preserve the sanctuary and protect its inhabitants for as long as possible, considering every moment spent within the sanctuary as providing students with that much better chance of surviving in the wild, where many kinds of two-legged predators roam. At the beginning of this essay, a claim was made that there may be few people in formal education or within the general realm of religious institutions who exhibit all of the foregoing qualities. Although they might have this or that characteristic or some small subset of such qualities. If this is so, why should this be the case? One critical reason for this state of affairs is that there are few places of learning which have the resources or competence necessary for teaching people how to be teachers in the foregoing sense. You can't teach what you don't know, understand, appreciate, or aspire to. A second fundamental reason for the set of circumstances existing vis-a-vis the relative absence of quote-unquote teachers who exhibit the foregoing qualities is the following. There are many different elements within formal education and within the sphere of influence of what passes for spirituality in many areas that tend to conspire together, knowingly and unknowingly, in order to drive out anyone who demonstrates the qualities of being a teacher in the sense outlined in this essay. This is done because teachers, in the sense outlined here, threaten too many vested interests that seek to initiate students, whether of this world or the next, into a modern form of indentured servitude within certain kinds of political, economic, philosophical, and religious ideologies, and as such, teachers in the sense specified in the essay are largely antithetical to the agendas being pushed in much of elementary, secondary, and post-secondary education, as well as in all too many mosques, churches, temples, and synagogues. As such, teachers in the foregoing sense are considered to be loose cannons, who cannot be relied on to serve political, economic, social, religious, and expedient interests which are not capable of serving an individual's essential potential for self-realization. Occasionally, in spite of the all-too-common mind and heart set within formal education and religious settings, One comes across someone who reflects the qualities of a teacher as outlined in this essay. However, my experience has been that more often than not, to the extent one comes across such people at all, one will find them outside the hallowed halls of formal education and beyond the doors of religious institutions. And even with respect to such exception, those special individuals may become an endangered species. For the same destructive forces that are shaping much of modern education and religious institutions are also present outside those institutional realms, and such malevolent forces wish to be rid of the influence of individuals with the qualities of an authentic teacher for reasons alluded to in the foregoing essay. The qualities of a teacher which have been briefly described in this essay are not the sort of characteristics which can be used to form rules of thumb through which one can identify whether someone is or is not an authentic spiritual guide. In fact, judging whether or not such qualities are present takes time, and in the amount of time that would be required to make such determinations, one already might have exposed oneself to considerable risk in the case of an individual who, despite initial impressions, was in reality an abusive, manipulative charlatan, and as a result, one would stand a very good chance of being yesterday's lunch for such a shark, while one was still trying to establish what the actual quality or character of such an individual was. The foregoing qualities have been given as food for thought. Reflection is one of the tools we have through which to try to defend ourselves against spiritually abusive individuals.
This week's edition of the Sufi Reflections podcast has been brought to you by the Interrogative Imperative Institute, where the process of asking questions becomes an artful journey to solutions for life.
If you would like to download past editions of the Sufi Reflections podcast, or if you would like to be updated about what is happening in conjunction with the Sufi Reflections podcast, or if you would like to leave comments concerning the podcast, please go to Sufi-Reflections.com, all lowercase letters, and maybe we'll see you there. Thank you. Well, that's all for this edition of the Sufi Reflections podcast. I hope you have enjoyed the program and found the various segments thought-provoking and interesting. As indicated in the introduction to this podcast, programs will be produced on a regularly irregular basis. Essentially, this means that the next edition may appear next week, or then again, there may not be another podcast for several weeks. Sufi Reflections gets done, God willing, as time permits. And unfortunately, time doesn't always permit me the degrees of freedom necessary to put programs together, which is a lot more time-consuming than the running length of any given podcast. Nonetheless, I will strive mightily to provide a new program for your listening enjoyment in the near future. Until then, Assalamu alaikum.